2 Samuel 5-6, the third talk in a series in 2 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on February 22, 2009 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're looking at 2 Samuel, chapters 5 and 6. In chapters 3 and 4, finally, the way had been cleared for David to become king of all of Israel. Saul has died. His leading commander, Abner, was put to death. And then the king, the son of Saul that had taken control of the northern part of Israel, Ish-bosheth, he had also been killed. So now all of those people who could have power in Israel, they've all been eliminated. And David didn't eliminate any of them. They were all eliminated by others. But now David is now in line, in position to take his spot as king of all of Israel. First few verses of chapter 5. Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "Behold, we are your bone and your flesh. Previously, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and in. And the Lord said to you, 'You will shepherd my people Israel, and you will be a ruler over Israel.' So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them before the Lord at Hebron. Then they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years. At Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah." So the elders of the tribes of Israel, they come to Hebron, where David is located, so they come to him. And for three reasons, there are three bases for their desire to give him power, to grant him kingship over all of Israel. The first is, "We are your bone and your flesh." He is an Israelite. He is a descendant of Abraham. Secondly, "When Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and in." That David enjoyed a high position under King Saul. He was Saul's main military commander, had a lot of success at that position, so he has already demonstrated his leadership ability and has been and was loyal to Saul. And the third reason is that the Lord said to you, you will shepherd my people Israel and will be ruler over Israel. So it had been proclaimed by God that David would be Israel king over all of Israel. So for those three reasons, the elders want this to happen. As we had seen before, even before the death of Abner and Ish-bosheth, there was apparently some sentiment among the elders of Israel that they wanted David to become king over them. And now all of the obstacles have been removed, and he does indeed become king. So they meet together at Hebron. They make an agreement with David that he will indeed become king. This was the covenant that Abner had already arranged for, but he was unable to carry it out because he was put to death. So David becomes king now officially of all of Israel. He was 30 years old when he became king in Hebron over Judah. So he was king of just Judah for 7.5 years. Then at the age of 37 and a half, he became king of all of Israel. And his total kingship is 40 years, 7.5 of those were just over Judah. So it's a relatively long reign. And it's interesting that as we go on in 2 Samuel, there isn't a lot said about the middle part of his reign. We have most about the end of his reign when things get tricky. Next section. Now the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land. And they said to David, "You shall not come in here, but the blind and lame shall turn you away," thinking, "David cannot enter here." Nevertheless, David captured the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. And David said on that day, "Whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him reach the lame and the blind who are hated by David's soul through the water tunnel." Therefore, they say, "The blind or the lame shall not come into the house." So David lived in the stronghold and called it the city of David. And David built all around from the Milo and inward, and David became greater and greater, for the Lord God of hosts was with him. So the first significant act that David takes as king now of all of Israel is to conquer Jerusalem. Jerusalem had been an outpost, is occupied by the Jebusites. They had been there for a very long time. The Jebusites are a Canaanite tribe. And they had occupied that particular city probably for 1,000 years or so. And when the Israelites came into Canaan, they had been told by God that they were supposed to wipe out the Canaanites. That would have included the Jebusites. But Jerusalem was located in the area that was given to the tribe of Benjamin, and they had not been able to drive the Jebusites out. I suspect that at least one of the reasons that David is interested in taking Jerusalem is to drive the Jebusites out. It's probably an irritant to have these Canaanites located right in the middle of an area that is otherwise controlled by Israel. But additionally, the Israelites had been commanded to drive the Canaanites out, and they had not done it. And I think David is wanting to finish up part of that assignment that had been given to them by God. Jerusalem, at this time, the city that the Jebusites had occupied, I've never been there. I've seen a few pictures, and I've seen a few topographical maps, so I'll describe it a little bit to you. It's on the top of this rock formation, fairly steep sides. They were steeper back then. They're less steep now because for millennia, garbage has been thrown over the side, and the valleys have filled up to a certain extent. But it was steep slopes down to valleys on two sides, and it's kind of a triangle shaped, and then it slopes off more gently on the third side. On the top of the rock, at the very peak, is where the Jebusites had built their city, Jerusalem. Now it spreads all over the place, but even in the time of Jesus, it had spread down that triangle, and was much bigger then than it was during the time of the Jebusites. The Jebusites were just right at the peak, a very difficult place to get to. It was extremely well fortified. They had built a wall around it. It was well fortified and was able to withstand sieges very well, which is very important in those times. They had a source of water. The source of water obviously in a siege is one of your most critical things. There's a spring at the bottom of the hill. They needed the water from that spring, and so that's a bit of a problem. They were able to dig a tunnel down through the rock formation and through a system of tunnels that they carved in the rocks, were able to get access down to that spring. There have been excavations done. There have been in an attempt to reconstruct what was their tunnel system. That system was changed, developed over time, became more. It was designed to make it harder for people to get into Jerusalem by the water tunnel as time went on. But even at the time of David, there was, they used to think that there was this 40-foot drop that went straight down, and they would lower buckets down there into a pool of water that was collected from spring water that ran down a tunnel into a pool underneath the rock, if you can see what I'm saying. Jerusalem's here. There is the spring down here. Water ran from the spring down through a channel carved in the rock, and then there was a series of tunnels that came down here, a 40-foot drop, and they would lower buckets down into the pool and pull their water up there. More recent excavations have called into question whether that 40-foot drop was a part of their system at the time of David. It looks like that probably was not a part of it. But they've discovered that down where the spring was, they had built towers, fortifications to protect the spring water. So in order to get to the water or get to the system of tunnels that takes the water, that people use to get the water up into Jerusalem, that was all fortified and very difficult to get through. Whatever the system was, the Jebusites had great confidence in it. They thought it was impregnable, that even the lame and the blind would be able to defend Jerusalem against any invaders. That's what they're thinking. And David, looking at the situation, says, the way into Jerusalem is through the water tunnels. That's got to be the way in. Any other way is not going to be successful. It's Joab, apparently. We know from other sources that it's Joab that's the one who takes on this task. He's the one that makes his way to the water tunnel and then up those tunnels up into Jerusalem itself with some fighting men. And they, with that, with Joab's efforts going up the tunnel, they are able to defeat the Jebusites. The Israelites take control of Jerusalem, and David decides to move his capital from Hebron, which was right in the middle of Judah. He moves that into Jerusalem, farther north, which is part of Benjamin. That's very important. Especially following a 7.5-year civil war, there's this problem of unifying now this group of people that have been fighting among themselves. And if David were to have remained in Hebron, he would have remained in the minds of most of the Israelites the king of Judah. He has to move his capital so he's closer to the people of Israel and can be identified as not just the king of Judah, but the king of Israel. And so Jerusalem is his choice. It's a good location for a variety of reasons. It's well fortified, et cetera, but it's also north and outside of Judah and part of Israel proper. So David moves there. He improves upon the stronghold that the Jebusites had built. It says David built all around from the Milo and inward. There are a few words in this section that don't show up elsewhere in the Old Testament, or there is a parallel account in Second Chronicles, but it says essentially the same thing, so it isn't helpful in determining what these words mean. The Milo is one of those words. The water tunnel was a word that they couldn't translate for a long time, but then through archaeology it made sense what that had to be. The Milo, again, they don't know what that means for sure, but the word Milo is related to the Hebrew word for fill, so they think that this is infill that was created, a terracing kind of thing that was done on the sides of the slopes headed up to Jerusalem. And in all probability, what David did was built up on that fill area on the side where the springs were, and built the city walls, extended the city walls so that they included the spring itself. In any case, he's made Jerusalem more fortified, stronger, and it becomes his capital city, capital of all of Israel. Next section. Then Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David with cedar trees and carpenters and stonemasons, and they built a house for David. And David realized that the Lord had established him as king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. Meanwhile, David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem after he came from Hebron, and more sons and daughters were born to David. Now these are the names of those who were born to him in Jerusalem: Shammua, Shobab, Nathan, Solomon, Ibhar, Elishua, Nepheg, Japhia, Elishama, Eliada, and Eliphelet. So now David is king of all Israel, has a new capital established at Jerusalem. He's taken control of all of Israel. He's unified Israel. Now Israel is becoming a power to be reckoned with. Israel's become a substantial kingdom now for the first time. And other kings are recognizing that fact. So Hiram, the king of Tyre. Tyre is to the north. It's what we come to know as the Phoenicians. The culture of the people in the north is very similar to Canaanite culture, but it goes on and develops in a different direction. Hiram, the king of Tyre, decides that he wants to be on good terms with David and the Israelites. And as a result, he recognizes the accomplishments of David and wants to help David out. So he sends messengers to David with cedar trees. That's a very important commodity that is in abundance in Lebanon, but is not in abundance in Israel. And carpenters and stonemasons. The Phoenicians would have had a lot more expertise in constructing cities and fortifications and that sort of thing. So he has provided all of those to David for him to work on Jerusalem, beautify it, build his palaces, etc. And that's what David does. And it says, David realized that the Lord had established him as king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. David's been through a lot. David has done a lot to gain the position that he has gained. But nevertheless, it is crystal clear to David that this would not have come about, so it would not have come to pass had it not been for God's working behind the scenes. So it's really God that has accomplished this goal. And he, David, had been exalted as king for the sake of his people Israel. But this had all been done for the sake of God's people. God wanted this accomplishment to be achieved. So David, acting like other kings in the areas, takes on more concubines and wives. We already saw that he had, what, 7 wives, I think, at last count. He takes on more. And he has more sons and daughters born to him. We only have a few of his sons listed here. We know from other places that there were other sons in addition to these. And there were a number of daughters. We don't know how many. And none of those are listed in this particular passage. Only one of these sons becomes significant later, and that's Solomon, who will succeed David after David dies. Next section. When the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to seek out David. And when David heard of it, He went down to the stronghold. Now the Philistines came and spread themselves out in the valley of Rephaim. Then David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up against the Philistines? Wilt thou give them into my hand?" And the Lord said to David, "Go up, for I will certainly give the Philistines into your hand." So David came to Baal Perazim and defeated them there. And he said, "The Lord has broken through my enemies before me like the breakthrough of waters." Therefore he named that place Baal Perazim, and they abandoned their idols there. So David and his men carried them away. If you put yourself in the shoes of the Philistines just 7.5 years earlier, it looked like the Philistines had dealt a death blow to all of Israel when they defeated Saul's army, killed Saul and his sons in the valley of Jezreel. Then for the intervening 7.5 years, the Philistines are probably thinking, we don't have to worry about the Israelites because they're killing each other. They're conducting a civil war. The civil war between Israel and Judah. So the Philistines are probably, they aren't worried about their neighbors. They're working on their own prosperity, just waiting for the Israelites to kill each other and be done with them. But now David, who had fought for the Philistines earlier, who had been king of Judah, and I'm sure seen as a friend fighting against Israel from the perspective of the Philistines, now he's the king of all of Israel. And now it's a different situation. This looks a little bit ominous to the Philistines to have the Israelites now united and their enemy. So the Philistines come with a large army, and they come to the valley of Rephaim, which is just a couple miles from Jerusalem. David, as is typical, inquires of the Lord as to whether he should fight against the Philistines, and God's response is, go up against them and I will give them into your hand. So David takes his army and they fight against the Philistines in the valley of the Rephaim, and they rout the Philistines, drive them away. The Philistines flee the field of battle. They flee it in great haste, and they leave their idols there. So they've been defeated, they're running away, and they leave their idols, I assume stone or wood, whatever, they leave them in the battlefield. Reminiscent of an earlier event in which the Israelites, in their attempts to defeat the Philistines, had decided to carry the Ark of the Covenant with them into battle, hoping that that would help them and that they would be able to defeat the Philistines. But in fact, what happened is the Israelites were routed and they left the Ark of the Covenant behind, and the Philistines took it and put it in their temple. Now we have the opposite happening. The Philistines had their idols with them in battle. They have fled, leaving their idols behind, and David and his men pick them up and carry them away. I assume that David and his men destroyed those idols, but it doesn't make that specific. Next section. Now the Philistines came up once again and spread themselves out in the valley of Rephaim. And when David inquired of the Lord, he said, "You shall not go directly up. Circle around behind them and come at them in front of the balsam trees. And it shall be when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then you shall act promptly, for then the Lord will have gone out before you to strike the army of the Philistines." Then David did so, just as the Lord had commanded him, and struck down the Philistines from Geba as far as Gezer. So the Philistines make another attempt. They gather again in the valley of Rephaim, and they're ready to attack the Israelites. David once again inquires of the Lord. This time, David gets instructions with respect to how he should conduct this battle. Rather than attack them head on, they're supposed to go around behind, and they're supposed to wait for a sign from God. They're supposed to wait until they hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees. It's almost certainly not balsam trees. This is another word that's difficult to translate. We don't know exactly what it means, but it's some kind of tree. They're supposed to wait till they hear the sound of marching, so probably the wind blowing through the trees or something that sounds like marching. And that will be the signal of when they are to attack. And David does just as God had told him to do. And when he does so, the Philistines are routed completely. And they are struck down. They struck down the Philistines from Geba as far as Gezer, which is far to the south. Excuse me. So this time the Philistines are thoroughly defeated. And David has accomplished what none of the Israelites had been able to do before. He has soundly defeated the Philistines. Okay, so now David is secure in Jerusalem. He's established his capital there. He's expanded the boundaries of Israel and is feeling secure. The kingdom has been made safe. So he decides to move the Ark of the Covenant from the place where it has been for a long time. He's going to move that to Jerusalem. Verse 1, chapter 6. Now David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. And David arose and went with all the people who were with him to Baal El Judah, which to bring up from there the ark of God, which is called by the name, the very name of the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned above the cherubim. And they placed the ark of God on a new cart, that they might bring it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, and Uzzah and Ahio, the son of Abinadab, were leading the new cart. So they brought it with the ark of God from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, and Ahio was walking ahead of the ark. Meanwhile, David and all the house of Israel were celebrating before the Lord with all kinds of instruments made of fir wood and with lyres, harps, tambourines, castanets, and cymbals. This is a big event. The Ark of the Covenant, as you'll recall, had been in this location, at Kiriath Jearim. It had been located there ever since they got the Ark back from the Philistines. And that happened before Saul even became king, so it was many years ago. And it has just been stationed there in the house of Abinadab, who was a Levite. He was a priest. So it's just been resting there all this time. And David wants to... Oh, and by the way, the Baal Judah is just another name for Kiriath Jearim. Interestingly, in several places in this narrative, it switches back and forth between the Canaanite terminology for these places and Hebrew terminology for these places. It even goes back and forth between Canaanite versions of people's names and the Hebrew version of these names. I'm not sure the significance of that, but it is an interesting thing to note. David wants to bring this most significant symbol of God's presence within the nation of Israel. He wants to bring that to Jerusalem and give it a permanent home. So this is a very big event. It must have taken a lot of planning. There are a lot of people involved. He's got 30,000 men that come to be a part of this procession. They build a new cart to put the Ark of the Covenant onto. If you will recall, That's the way that the Philistines returned the Ark of the Covenant to the Israelites. Remember, after the Philistines had captured the Ark of the Covenant, they put it in their temple, and they began to have problems. There were health issues, and their statues kept falling down in front of the Ark of the Covenant. And so the Philistines decided, we're getting rid of this thing. So they built a new cart, and they put the Ark of the Covenant on a new cart, and they let it go, and it carried the animals, pulled the cart back to the Israelites. And so that's how it was returned to the Israelites. David is building a new cart to convey the Ark this time as well. In addition, there are people with all kinds of instruments, so this is quite a celebration, this is quite a procession that's accompanying the Ark. And the sons of Abinadab is the man who owns the house where the Ark has been stored for a few decades now. His sons, Uzzah and Ahio, I guess, they accompany the Ark. They go with the Ark. Ahio is walking ahead, and Uzzah is following behind. Next section. But when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out toward the Ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen nearly upset it. And the anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah, and God struck him down there for his irreverence. And he died there by the Ark of God. And David became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah. And that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. So David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, "How can the Ark of the Lord come to me?" And David was unwilling to move the Ark of the Lord into the city of David with him. But David took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. Thus the Ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, 3 months, and the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. It was a very, very interesting incident. The Ark is being pulled on this new cart by these oxen. There's this big procession, lots of people there. It gets, I think this is about halfway between Kiriath Jearim and Jerusalem. It gets to the place where the Ark is on the threshing floor of Nacon. And something happens. It's not clear exactly what happens. The oxen slip or stumble or something. And the cart is jostled. And it looks like the Ark is going to fall off. So Uzzah reaches out and grabs the Ark to keep it from falling off. And God strikes him dead. In response to this, it says, David became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah. The commentaries suggest that he was angry at Uzzah for doing such an irreverent act. I suspect not. I suspect that David is angry actually at God. And we'll talk about this more. I'll talk about this more later. But David is angry. And I think he's angry because, why did this make sense? Why would God strike him down for doing that particular act? But David, having seen this happen, is saying, I don't know how to get this thing to Jerusalem. The deal's off. We're leaving it here because I don't know how to get it from here to Jerusalem. I don't know what's going on. I don't know why God did what he did. And so the Ark is parked there in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. Obed-Edom shows up in Chronicles we find out there that he is not only a priest, he's not only a Levite, but he's actually of the tribe of Aaron. So he is higher ranked than were the Levites that had the ark earlier. The Levites worked in the temple. They were even, Levites could even carry the ark on poles. But Levites could not touch the ark or get into it, as opposed to the descendants of Aaron, who apparently could do so. So it's parked there for 3 months. And while it's there, God blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. It's not clear what form that blessing took, but apparently it was obvious that Obed-Edom was enjoying a blessing as a result of having the ark's presence there. David seems to be encouraged by that and tries once again now to take the ark. Verse 12. Now it was told King David, saying, "The Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him on account of the ark of God." And David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom into the city of David with gladness. And so it was that when the bearers of the ark of the Lord had gone 6 paces, he sacrificed an ox and a fatling. And David was dancing before the Lord with all his might. And David was wearing a linen ephod. So David and all the house of Israel were bringing up the ark of the Lord with shouting and the sound of the trumpet. Then it happened as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David that Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out of the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord. And she despised him in her heart. So they brought in the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent which David had pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And when David had finished offering the burnt offering and the peace offering, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts. Further, he distributed to all the people, to all the multitude of Israel, both to men and women, a cake of bread and one of dates and one of raisins to each one. Then all the people departed, each to his house. So David learns that there has been a blessing on Obed-Edom and his household because of the ark, and apparently is encouraged by that. And I suspect has interpreted that to mean that God has not decided to punish Israel and punish David for moving the ark. That he's interpreting that as God's still smiling on them and being gracious towards them. So he's encouraged and decides to bring the ark from there into Jerusalem. But this time, no new cart. This time he's going to do it the way that it was prescribed in the Old Testament commandments. It's supposed to be carried on poles by Levites. So instead of putting on a cart, now it is carried. And they carry it 6 paces and then offer sacrifices. So they just start and then offer sacrifices to God. And then after having offered the sacrifices, presumably, then they carry it the rest of the way. It wasn't a long distance, it's just a few miles. I don't remember exactly how far. David is a part of this procession, dancing before the Lord with all his might, and he's wearing a linen ephod, which is the garb of a priest. Only a priest can wear the linen ephod. So this whole procession moves along, all the music and all the festivities, all of the celebration that accompanies it. They get to the outside of Jerusalem, and David's wife, Michal, looks out of a window and sees him, and it says she despised him in her heart. And we'll sort that out in just a minute. They bring the ark to Jerusalem. They put it inside of a tent that David had set up for just that purpose. They offer burnt offerings and peace offerings to God. And when that is done, David blesses all the people and then gives to all of them three cakes, a cake of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins. And then having done those things, all of the people go home. The last section. But when David returned to bless his household, Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "How the king of Israel distinguished himself today. He uncovered himself today in the eyes of his servants' maids as one of the foolish ones shamelessly uncovers himself." So David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord, over Israel. Therefore, I will celebrate before the Lord, and I will be more lightly esteemed than this, and will be humble in my own eyes. But with the maids of whom you have spoken, with them I will be distinguished." And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. It is interesting that in this passage, it refers to Michal two times, saying, "Michal, the daughter of Saul," not "Michal, the wife of David." So there's this connection is being made between Michal and her father, that apparently her father's side is kind of showing itself here. And it would appear that the issue is that David has acted in an unking-like manner. David has not been dignified. David is wearing the ephod, and it's possible that the ephod would have been shorter than the king robes. The ephod apparently was just below the knees or something like that. And that could be part of what she's hinting at and saying that he uncovered himself today in the eyes of his servants' maids as one of the foolish ones shamelessly uncovers himself. Apparently, what she's suggesting is that there was more of him visible than was in good taste. Her complaint seems to be he's not acting like a king. Her father acted like a king, but David is not acting like a king. He's acting in an undignified manner. David's response is, that is not the highest priority for me. The highest priority for me is to express my thanks and my gratitude towards God for what he has done and what he has achieved and the relationship that he has had to me and the people of Israel. He points out to Michal, it was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord, over Israel. I suspect that was not received well by Michal. It seems like he could have couched that a little better, but he didn't. Therefore, I will celebrate before the Lord because God has accomplished this thing that he had promised from decades earlier. This is really a remarkable event and development in David's eyes. And he goes on to say, and I will be more lightly esteemed than this, and will be humble in my own eyes, but with the maids of whom you have spoken, with them I will be distinguished. And I think what he's saying is, I don't care about what I look like. I don't care whether I look dignified or not. I'm willing to be humbled completely if that's what it takes for me to express my gratitude towards God. And the maids that you're talking about, those other humble servants, they understand the sentiment behind my actions, and they've respond. They know how to take that it's actually a good sign and not a bad sign. And the suggestion is that Michal doesn't understand that. She doesn't understand the heart of David, just as Saul didn't understand the heart of David. And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. And apparently we were to see that as God's way of responding to Michal and her lack of understanding of David's heart. Okay, there is a lot that could be talked about in this section. There are just a couple things that I'm going to touch on, and then hopefully there'll be time that we can pursue other things with questions and comments. The first is something that has never occurred to me before, but I think it's worthy of consideration. It is interesting that David here is in this procession to Jerusalem, is dressed as a priest, because David was not of priestly lineage. So on what basis can he wear the priest's garb? One commentator had a suggestion that I thought was very interesting. He speculates that David became priest by conquest. We know from way back in the time of Abraham that there was a king of Salem who was also a priest of the God Most High, and that was Melchizedek. So the king and the priest of Salem were the same person. To be the king of Salem was to be the priest of Salem. It is possible that by right of conquest and becoming king of Jerusalem, David also becomes priest of Jerusalem. This is what the commentator is, Bergen, and this is what he says. David's use of the ephod suggests that he possessed the credentials of a priest. How David attained sacerdotal status is not described in the Bible, but the acquisition of priestly status in the order of Melchizedek by the Davidic family line is hinted at in Psalms 110, verse 4. If indeed this title applied to David as well as one of his descendants, he most likely acquired it by right of conquest. Having conquered Jerusalem, he became possessor of all the titles and honors traditionally accorded to the king of the city. Melchizedek, having been Jerusalem's priest king of God Most High, that is, of Yahweh, David, as king of Jerusalem, would have become a priest of Yahweh. Furthermore, it's interesting that at the end of the ceremony, he gives a blessing and then gives food to each person, which is what Melchizedek did with respect to Abraham after Abraham defeated the four kings from the east and brought back the hostages that had been taken. So it's an interesting possibility. The most significant thing in this section is the death of Uzzah. I find that perplexing. Why did God strike down a Levitical priest who sees the ark falling off this cart and wants to keep it from falling off? It seems to me that that is a reverent act and not an irreverent act. So why would God strike him down? I can understand, and I would be very sympathetic with David's response. It seems to me that David's response of anger is anger towards God. Why did you do this? Why did you strike him down for what he did? His intent was good. And this is the David who, if you'll recall earlier, went to the priest when he was fleeing from Saul. He went to the priests at Nob. He said, "We're starving. We need food and we need weapons." And he goes to the priests, but the only bread that they have is the showbread. And that is only to be eaten by the priests and the Levites. David does not, and his men don't qualify. But they give him the showbread. And that incident is referred to by Jesus approvingly. That was the right thing to do under those circumstances, because they were in desperate need of food, and that was more important than maintaining the ceremonial aspects of the showbread. So that has happened earlier in David's life. I'm sure he's thinking here, why zap him when his intentions are good and there's just a slight infraction of the rules? I don't know the answer to that question, but I think what's going on here is David wants to move the ark to Jerusalem and give it a permanent home, and for good reasons. He wants to have God's place. He wants God positioned in Jerusalem itself. All of that is a good thing. But it is interesting. I don't know why he didn't have the ark carried according to the Old Testament commandments. Why he didn't have it carried on poles by Levites. But rather, he has it conveyed in the Philistine fashion on the new cart. I think that's very interesting. And I'm not sure why David did that. David has had close association with the Philistines for a number of years. And it could be that David has absorbed some Philistine culture. And why in this particular instance he would use the Philistine way, I'm not sure, but I'm sure he has picked up some Philistine values as well. In any case, I think what God is communicating is, don't take me for granted. Don't take me lightly. That David is not being careful with respect to God. David is not being respectful with respect to God. He's decided God is just inherently on his side, and not recognizing that God is the creator of the universe. He's not to be taken lightly. As a result, I think that Uzzah, I'm not really sure how to think about Uzzah. Was he unaware of the commandment? Or did he know it and just in the moment decide that it was more important to stop the ark from falling off? I'm not really sure. My inclination is to think that Uzzah really wasn't in the wrong, that his intent was right and isn't being punished, actually. But rather, this is an act that God is carrying out as a lesson for David. And it's interesting, if that's the case, then Uzzah died in order that David might learn something. But that's not unprecedented. There are other innocent people that are going to die so that David can learn something, and that happens a few chapters further on. But I am struck once again, I think, and it's something that I think we can never be reminded of enough, that to use the words of C.S. Lewis, God is not a tame lion. That every time we think that we've got him figured out, every time we think that he's just ours to do our bidding, anytime we begin to take him for granted, he's always going to burst out of that in one way or another. And it's important for us to recognize that he's not just our plaything. He's the creator of the universe. He's the maker of us all. And he does. It's interesting, he doesn't always zap people when they do things bad. He didn't kill any of the Philistines who had put the ark on a new cart and sent it back to the Israelites. He acts strategically. He makes himself known when he chooses to do so. And there are other times, long periods of time, when he's quite silent and in the background. But when the time comes, he makes himself known. Okay, there's lots we could talk about. We have a little bit of time.
Would it have been hard for us, for someone who is trying to lay claim to the throne of Israel, to do it without the support of the elders?
Yes. I think that would have been, it would have been virtually impossible, I think. I mean, that apparently, certainly at these early stages when the monarchy is just being established in Israel, that seems to be critical to have the support of the elders. So it's interesting that David has, this is one of those things that's really outside of David's control. He has to have the support of the elders, and yet he can't make them support him. That's something that God has to orchestrate and bring about, and that's what God did.
Salem, Jerusalem, and the house of David, what's kind of the relationship between all of those three?
Well, Salem apparently is just the older name for Jerusalem. It was called that in the time of Abraham, but it becomes known, and it means, Salem means peace. I don't know what Jeru adds to that. I don't remember.
Teaching.
What?
Teaching.
Teaching?
When I was there, they always handed out every tract.
Teaching peace. And then the house of David, the city of David, it becomes known as the city of David, which was apparently fairly common in the culture, that if when a king would conquer a city and make it his place of residence, it becomes known as the city of that king. So once he conquers it and makes it his place of residence, it becomes the city of David.
I can't even say his name right now. Melchizedek.
Melchizedek. Uh-huh.
Melchizedek. Would you, if I have any knowledge of this besides just the general knowledge, I don't know where it is. So I don't think I know. Like who? So Melchizedek was a conqueror of Salem, you said?
Melchizedek was the king and priest of Salem.
Okay.
In the time of Abraham.
All right.
Abraham, if you'll recall, this is in Genesis. There was an attack on the cities of Canaan by kings from the east. They came in an alliance because they had control over the city-states in Canaan for a period of time, but the city-states of Canaan decided, we are not going to send tribute this year because we think we can get away with not sending it. And the kings in the east said, no, you can't. So they came to collect, and they swept through Canaan and beat up all the people who hadn't paid tribute, and that included the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, the cities of the plain. And in that incident, they took Lot and his family captive as part of their loot. So Abraham found out, and he and his servants took off after them and were able to take back the loot that those kings had taken, and that included Lot. And they brought that loot back, and the king of Salem, that is Melchizedek, met Abraham, and for what Abraham had done, proclaimed a blessing on him and gave him a gift of food. And that's significant. So he was blessed by the priest of, and Melchizedek was given the title, the priest of the Most High God.
So, and he had that by virtue of conquest, you said?
No, he was the king of Jerusalem, and that was his title. He was a priest of Salem, the priest of the Most High God. Okay. Now, and what I'm saying here is, David now has conquered Jerusalem, that city.
Okay.
So now by conquest, David has right to that title, the twofold title, both king and priest of Salem, priest of the Most High God.
Interesting. So he kind of inherits that title. By conquest. Interesting.
That's what Bergen is suggesting, and I think that is an interesting possibility.
I have two questions, one because of the last question. But the first comment was on, is it Uzzah who touches the ark? It occurs to me that it could be because he was being presumptuous in the sense that the ark was a symbol of God in the midst of Israel, and he was reaching out to protect it, which was not his job. I mean, in a way, I mean, God, by doing that, not understanding fully that God is very capable of protecting what he wants to protect, and not basically not fully understanding the power of God, and that when it says that his anger burned against him, that his anger actually was against him.
Right.
But as God does, I mean, he uses one act to accomplish many things.
Right.
And
right.
So what you said about the cart and everything, that makes good sense too.
Right. That's possible.
The question over here, if Melchizedek was the priest of God Most High, and because of all the context of it, seems like, I mean, really of the priest of God, I mean, the God that is the Most High, and yet, how does he relate to the Jebusites? I mean, if David was the one that he assumed that title by being conquered, then presumably that title was, I mean, if that were the case, then the title was passed down.
Right, right.
And so were these people worshipers of God? And if so, how does that come into David conquering them? And I don't know if you...
Well, I would assume that the title remained. They continued to be worshipers of the God Most High. But one can be in name a worshiper of the God Most High without being a worshiper of the God Most High. And my assumption is that the Jebusites have gone the way of all Canaanites. And my assumption is that because God told the Israelites to wipe out all the Canaanites when their iniquity was full. So I assume that they went the way of all Canaanites, so that the title remained. I don't think the substance was continued.
But David, I mean, if it's true that that's how he got the title, that there was something there. I mean, that he was able to inherit. I mean, even if just a name, they were worshiping what they thought was, I mean, at least acknowledging God?
Or? Well, I don't know. But what he's tapping into is he's inheriting what Melchizedek had. And I think what we're to understand is Melchizedek really was one who worshiped the God who was there. Whether his successors did or not doesn't matter, I don't think.
So it's like if David was actually fulfilling, I mean, it was like a fulfillment almost of who Melchizedek was.
Right. He's inheriting the title to what Melchizedek actually was.
Mm-hmm. Which is very interesting in terms of Jesus.
It is very interesting. It really is.
I guess I'd like to reemphasize kind of the sin of familiarity that we have with God.
Mm-hmm.
Uzzah, is that his name?
That's
good.
Yep, it is now.
He was a lesser ranked Levite, is that correct?
Yeah, he was a Levite, but not a descendant of Aaron.
And so the ark had been at his house, as it were, for mm-hmm. years,
mm-hmm.
and presumably there was blessing upon his house as well.
Mm-hmm.
That not only he could recognize, but others could recognize.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess if I bring that home to me, there's a sense in which I forget that God is good, mm-hmm. and I attribute the blessings of God associated with my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing it right, mm-hmm. therefore God is blessing
mm-hmm.
me,
mm-hmm.
instead of saying, if there is goodness in me, it is because God is good,
mm-hmm.
not because I am good.
Yeah.
And I think the same sin a familiarity occurs in David's heart as well. And I think God's response to that is, no, I'm good, and
yeah.
you're not.
Yeah, yeah. That's a tough one. It's so easy to lose track of it. And we do it all the time and have to be kind of called on the carpet and reminded. It's tough.
I'm kind of curious. Was that, I can't remember for the life of me, in previous to this event, was there any command that either Moses or David or any of the other prophets previous to that received that anybody that touches the ark is going to be zapped immediately?
Well, it doesn't say they'll be zapped immediately, but the penalty for it was death. It doesn't say that God will do it, but there's the penalty is death. That's the way. That's what it says in Numbers. I think it's chapter 4.
And it wasn't specified who would actually mete out that judgment, whether they would be killed by another Levite or...
I don't believe so. I think it's just that the penalty is death.
And is that the only instance in the Old Testament where somebody actually tried to touch the ark for any reason?
That's the only one I can recall. That's the only one I recall. Numbers 4:15. Let me look and see what it says. It says, and when Aaron and his sons have finished covering the holy objects and all the furnishings of the sanctuary, when the camp is to set out after that, the sons of Kohath shall come to carry them so that they may not touch the holy objects and die. These are the things in the tent of meeting which the sons of Kohath are to carry. Mm-hmm. Okay, we gotta quit. Thanks.
Thank you.